This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. It is our pleasure to have Peter Sprigg back with us on the show. Peter is Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at the Family Research Council, or FRC, in Washington, D.C. Peter is the author of the book, Outrage, How Gay Activists and Liberal Judges Are Trashing Democracy to Redefine Marriage. Peter is also the author of a new FRC policy paper entitled Marriage on Trial, State Laws Defining Marriage as the Union of One Man and One Woman Are Valid under the Constitution of the United States. We're going to be talking with Peter today about some of the important questions he answers in this paper. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, as we see proponents of the redefinition of marriage pushing this notion that sexual orientation is comparable to a civil right, we have seen in the state of Virginia a federal judge actually recently striking down that state's marriage laws as unconstitutional, and in doing so, citing the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Loving v. Virginia case, which dealt with the state's previous ban on interracial marriage. Tell us about that case for a moment, if you would, and whether you believe it was proper for the judge in this case in Virginia to reference the Loving decision in making a determination about whether a constitutional provision that recognizes traditional marriage as valid in that state was proper or incorrect.
Right. That's one of the favorite precedents that the advocates of redefining marriage like to bring up, because they claim that there's an analogy between banning interracial marriage and what they call banning same-sex marriage. Now, we consider same-sex marriage to be an oxymoron, and that what the laws do is to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. It doesn't ban anything. It just defines it. But they see this analogy because both placed a limit, in both cases, a limit is placed on a person's ability to marry the spouse or partner of their choice. In the case of the bans on interracial marriage, that limit was based on the race of your partner. In the case of the current debates, the limit is based on the sex of your partner. But that's as far as the analogy goes, because no one has an unlimited right to marry the person of their choice. You can't marry a child, a close blood relative, or a person who's already married. So Loving could not stand for the proposition that you have an unlimited right to marry the person of your choice. Instead, what it represented was the significance of the classification based on race. It was not about marrying the person of your choice. It was about limiting that choice on the basis of race. Classifications based on race are subject to the strictest scrutiny. They will almost never be upheld. Because we have three constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, that were adopted after the Civil War specifically to eliminate legal discrimination based on race. We have no comparable constitutional provisions that have ever been adopted addressing the issue of sexual orientation. So there's no comparison at all. I argue that it's the advocates of same-sex marriage who actually resemble the people who banned interracial marriage, because in both cases, they were using and exploiting the institution of marriage in pursuit of a social goal which had nothing to do with the purposes of marriage. The bans on interracial marriage were exploiting marriage in support of the goal of racial segregation, but segregating the races has nothing to do with the purpose of marriage. And in the current climate, it's the advocates of same-sex marriage who are exploiting and using the institution of marriage to advance their social goal, which is the social acceptance of homosexuality itself. But the acceptance of homosexuality is not part of the public purpose of marriage. The bans on interracial marriage built walls between people to keep the races apart. Defining marriage as the union of a man and a woman builds a bridge across the most fundamental gap in the human race, bringing men and women together for the reproduction of the human race and for the good of society.
Well, that's a great way to put it. Now, Peter, what about the Supreme Court's June 2013 decision in the case of United States v. Windsor? You mentioned this earlier, but wanted to talk about that a little bit more. And this is the case where the court struck down part of our Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, as unconstitutional. Now, many of the federal judges that have overturned state marriage laws over the past year have referred directly to Windsor in their rulings. What does Windsor actually say, and should that decision provide a precedent for striking down state marriage laws?
Well, let me first review what the Defense of Marriage Act was about. It was passed by Congress in 1996 in response to some early state court decisions first in Hawaii and then in Alaska as well, that seemed to point to the possibility that courts in those states would declare a right to same-sex marriage. Now, the normal course of events is that if you are married in any one state within our country, then your marriage will be recognized as valid in every state. I mean, prior to the advent of same-sex marriage. The concern in the 1990s when the legalization or the redefinition of marriage to include same-sex couples began to appear as a realistic possibility, the concern was that if just one state were to do that, then same-sex couples from anywhere in the country could go to that state, get married, and return to their home state and demand recognition of their quote-unquote marriages, and you would have one state effectively redefining marriage for the entire country and for the federal government as well. So because of that concern, Congress passed the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which did two things. First of all, it specified that states do not have an obligation to recognize same-sex marriages conducted in other states. And secondly, it provided that for all purposes under the federal government, under federal law, this is not binding on the states, but under federal law, marriage would be defined as the union of one man and one woman, regardless of what any particular state might do. It was that latter provision, which is actually Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, which was challenged in the case United States versus Windsor, which the Supreme Court struck down. But you will see, if you read the decision closely, they emphasize the fact that the historical tradition had been that the federal government defers to the states with regard to who is married, and the federal government has not historically adopted its own definition of marriage until the Defense of Marriage Act. They said, you know, this is such a deviation from tradition that we believe that it constitutes discrimination against legally married couples who are of the same sex in the states that recognize them. So they said this discrimination against legally married same-sex couples was the effect of the Defense of Marriage Act, and that was not permissible. They did use this kind of language of due process and equal protection, in which some people believe provides a precedent for doing the same with the state definitions. But on the other hand, a very substantial part of that decision was saying the federal government must defer to the states, and the federal government should not create a system where there are two different definitions of marriage within the same state. Now, if the federal government is to defer to the definition of marriage in states that allow same-sex marriage, then the federal government should also defer to the definition of marriage in states that define marriage as the union of one man and one woman. That's why we believe that Windsor does not provide precedent for striking down the state marriage laws, because it was based so strongly on the importance of the federal government respecting state marriage law.
Well, that's a critically important thing to understand. Now, Peter, you begin your paper, Marriage on Trial, by explaining that the U.S. Constitution is actually silent on the issue of marriage. Why is this fact important for us to understand as the battle over marriage continues across our country and in our courts?
Well, one of the frustrating things, these liberal activist judges essentially pretend that the their preferred social policy is contained in the Constitution. I mean, they can't just strike down a law because they don't like it or because they think it's unfair by some sort of arbitrary standard of their own making. They only have the power to strike down laws, whether federal or state laws, if they are in violation of some express provision of the Constitution. And so that's why it's important for people to understand the Constitution is silent on the issue of marriage. And where the Constitution is silent, that means legislatures are free to legislate. The courts really should have no role in interfering with that. Justice Samuel Alito said that in his dissenting argument in the Windsor case, the case involving the Defense of Marriage Act last year. He made it quite clear that since the Constitution is silent on this issue, the Supreme Court should be silent on it too and leave it to the democratic process to be decided.
And speaking of the democratic process, it certainly seems that in the states where a majority of the citizens of the state have voted to implement an amendment to their constitution defining marriage as the union of one man and one woman, that really is the strongest display of that democratic process, when the people actually have the right to vote language into their constitution, and they have done so. And despite that, we still see federal courts across the country striking down not only existing marriage statutes, but also those constitutional marriage amendments.
Right. This is another reason why I am more optimistic than some people, more optimistic from the conservative perspective, that the Supreme Court will not strike down these state marriage definitions, because it would be a completely unprecedented situation. I mean, in contrast to Roe v. Wade, for example, their abortion decision in 1973, at that time, the majority of states were in the process of liberalizing their abortion laws. But here we have a situation where just within the last 15 years, a majority of states, 30 states, have amended their state constitutions to define marriage as the union of one man and one woman, in order for the people who are sovereign in our political system, taking that issue out of the hands of judges to decide, taking it out of the hands even of their elected representatives to decide, and saying, no, in our fundamental documents of our state government, we are going to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. It would be completely unprecedented for the Supreme Court to overturn the laws, not only the laws of a majority of states, but to overturn the constitutions of a majority of states, and not some archaic provision of those constitutions, but provisions that have been adopted by the people voting in referenda just within the last decade and a half. That would be something completely unprecedented in our political and legal system, and I'm skeptical that the court would want to go that far.
And of course, here in North Carolina, 61% of our voters in our state adopted our marriage amendment to our state constitution in May of 2012, so just a couple of years ago. Hopefully, we pray and share in your optimism that the Supreme Court will defer to the voters in the states and continue to enable the states to define marriage as the citizens through a democratic process see fit. Well, Peter, we are out of time for this show. Where can our listeners go to get a copy of FRC's publication, Marriage on Trial?
Well, you can find it on our website at frc.org, frc.org.
Peter Sprigg, I want to thank you so much for being back with us on Family Policy Matters and for the great work that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before we close, I'd like to invite you to follow the North Carolina Family Policy Council on Facebook. Just log in and find us at ncfamily.org. Again, at ncfamily.org. Be sure to like us when you visit. In addition, for instant updates on pro-family news of interest, follow us on Twitter at ncfamily.org.
Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.